I'm never one place for more than a couple of months, really, without taking off and getting on a plane or a train or going somewhere. And right now, I actually wouldn't mind going home for a good long time. So,
how long were your trips to Siberia most of the time? How much time did you actually spend here?
Well, this is one of the interesting things about the first trip. We were in Siberia for a month, and we were in the Baikal area for 2 weeks. And I sure as hell didn't think that was enough to turn into a book. And when I first began to pitch this, I basically led by saying, I have some really great material. I need to go back and do a lot more reporting. Because I knew as an editor, if somebody had come to me and said, well, I spent 2 weeks in Lake Baikal and I want to write a book about it. I've never been there before. I haven't been there since. I would say, you know, come back when you've got a lot more experience in this place. But I found this editor at Oxford University Press who, after reading this sort of treatment that I had read, that I had written of about 15,000 words, said, I think you have a book here. You just need to think about it differently than you've been thinking about it. Not as strictly straight-ahead journalism, but as a personal story, as, you know, making yourself a character, telling us about your journey, broadening it to include the journey, and then, you know, also the journey of the lake, the, you know, going deeply into the history and the culture, and making the lake a character. And I figured that Oxford University Press had a fair amount of institutional wisdom accumulated over 300 or 400 years, and that, you know, I should listen to the guy. Ultimately did spend, you know, much of the next 3 years doing a hell of a lot of research and more reporting, and I ultimately did go back for this epilogue, which I think made the book infinitely better. And I also, you know, made sure that I didn't make, I think I made sure that I didn't make some really egregious mistakes in my reporting by bringing in a lot of people who knew a lot better than I did about this part of the world in, you know, in terms of the science, the culture, the landscape, you know, all the stuff in which I was a stranger. So I had a lot of support to help fill in those holes, which, you know, as the editor and me knew were there in the material. And then I also, you know, kind of explicitly tried to make it clear, as I said at the beginning, that, you know, come with me on this journey while I explore this place for the first time. And sort of make that explicit, because I knew I couldn't get away with being an expert. I couldn't trying to be to present myself as an expert on this place. So I think that all helped sort of, you know, acquit the brevity of the time there. And I went back. I was there for 3 weeks the second time, and then another week elsewhere in Russia. So over.
I have two questions. One is, I forgot it. You said in the beginning that it was on a, it wasn't a fissure, it was something.
A rift.
A rift.
Yeah.
Which says to me an earthquake. Then later you said it was on a fault.
Yeah, well, they're sort of the same. I mean, the rift is this series of small and large faults that extends 1,000 kilometers or so roughly north to south in this part of Asia, and you know, I'm not a geologist, so I don't know the precise definition of rift, but, you know, a rift valley is a place where faults have moved, fault lines have separated, fallen, etc., and, you know, created this rift valley. Technically, it's called a Graben Lake, which is a lake in which sort of the bottom just keeps falling between these rifts, which are opening up. And they, you know, nobody knows for sure, but they think that it's probably, you know, I mean, there are faults all over the place, and some of them are more active than others. And this one, this series may have been activated by the impact of the Asian subcontinent of the Indian subcontinent into Asia, which is still moving and has pushed up the Himalayas and is having this incredible force that's still spreading across Asia. And that may be what's sort of causing this to still be active. So. You should ask a second question.
The second question was, how does Lake Baikal compare, you know, with Lake Titicaca in Bolivia?
You know, I don't know a whole lot about Lake Titicaca, except I would imagine that Titicaca is more like Lake Tahoe. It's a very high up, I know, and I think it was, you know, is probably formed by a combination of volcanism and glacier. That's just a guess on my part, but that's how Tahoe was formed. I think it's, you know, like Tahoe, it's very deep, although Tahoe is about 500 meters deep. Baikal is 1,670 meters deep, so it's more than three times as deep. But I actually don't know a lot about Titicaca, I'm afraid. But I imagine that it's similar in many ways to Tahoe. So, yes?
Yeah, I was curious, on your first trip to Russia, what your expectations or perceptions of the people were when you first arrived versus the reality, what you experienced?
That's a really complicated question. I think, you know, we have so many sort of stereotypes about Russians in the U.S., you know, sort of the biggest one being that, you know, that they're all out to get you one way or another. And it's hard to not to carry those with you. And certainly, I mean, even people I knew who had traveled extensively in that part of the world, you know, told me that I should be careful. I should be wary, you know, especially given that I didn't speak the language. But not overly, you know, wary or cautious, because you you won't experience anything if you are. And, you know, most people in Russia, like most people everywhere, are, you know, basically good people who are not, you know, out to harm anybody. And, you know, also that there was a certain sort of brusqueness to the culture, at least in terms of your initial engagement with people. I certainly found that to be true, but also that, like so many other places, you know, others that I've traveled and others that I've heard of, that if you have some way of establishing a relationship with somebody, if you have a friend who has introduced you, or, you know, just something that sort of gets you around that sort of initial sort of gruff engagement, that people are incredibly warm and generous. And I also found that to be true just about everywhere we went. So, you know, certainly once you get into an environment, whatever it is, stereotypes tend to fall away when you get into, you know, a real experience. But at the same time, I wouldn't say that those stereotypes are completely unfounded. As they, you know, all stereotypes are based on a degree of truth. Usually it's exaggerated and generalized. But, you know, we had this incredible experience where, like I said, just about everywhere we went, we encountered wonderful people who went out of their way to help us. Russians, Japanese, Germans, Americans. So, that's... Yes?
I came in right at the end of your introduction. You were talking about one of your first introductions to North Carolina was investigating the hog farms. And so, it's curious, like, after you left and you were, you know, how you described, when you were talking to someone else, how you described your experience.
Here?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I wasn't really investigating so much. I mean, this is a conference at which, you know, it was a four-day conference with lots of, you know, half-day field trips and stuff, so and you know, 90-minute panel discussions. My memory of it isn't completely clear, but I do think that was sort of the first time that this the problem of these confined animal feeding operations and especially the waste ponds that those create was, it's sort of the first time that it was really brought to my attention in a big way. And I think North Carolina was sort of an epicenter of it because it was a place that many of them had been built in the years leading up to that. But that the concern about them was just beginning to sort of bubble up. And I think not too long after that was that big spill into a river in eastern North Carolina that, you know, basically killed a couple of rivers, at least in the short term. And I don't remember the details of it. I mean, I edited a series of stories that we did, but that was back
you know, 93, 94, 95. With Orrin Pilkey and you know, the waterfront, that was right around the time of the it was a big Supreme Court ruling, I think having pertaining to South Carolina waterfront, I think, you know, efforts to restrict development and harden structures and the like. And with him, it was really just much more sort of like a basic lesson in how things work and how, like, we just are continually fighting against how things work on coastlines. It was very, it left a very strong impression on me. And, you know, I think that his analyses are basically right. I mean, you know, I haven't gone very deeply into it, but I think that, you know, he's been proven to be by, you know, storms and other things since. But, you know, again, I didn't go back to Boston and say, you know, we got to do all these stories on how everything's screwed up in North Carolina. You know, that wasn't at all what we were doing. So.
Let me ask a follow-up to
sure.
that. You know, as you said, you became more aware of the confinement mm-hmm. practices of intensive animal factory farming. Mm-hmm. And do you think that there's, like, in the general population, there's like a collective willful denial of how horrible that situation is?
It's kind of a leading question. But I think the answer, and willful, I don't know if it's willful. I mean, you know, you get into all these complicated cultural and psychological questions about how we experience things and think about things. I think that so much of the way that what we eat is delivered to us has been hidden for so much of the last century, really, but certainly starting, you know, in the 40s, perhaps. The industrial food supply system, you know, like so much else in industrial production, sort of basically hides the origin and the process from the end. And I think we generally don't recognize that, but I think we're really starting to. I think there's been a really big shift in the last few years, especially maybe in the last year and a half, with books like The Omnivore's Dilemma and other things which are really sort of illuminating the dark corners of industrial agriculture and industrial food production in a way that's having a really important effect on what people buy and what people eat. So, but I'm no expert. Yes?
If you were to write a second book about a place that you fantasized about going, you dreamed about going, what would be that place?
Well, I tell you, I left Cordova, Alaska, with a chapter list for a book about Cordova and the Copper River, which I immediately lost and never recovered. But I think that's an amazing place that I probably shouldn't even be talking about because somebody else will do it before I do, or because, like, I just don't want people to go there, you know. And that's certainly, you know, part of the. You know, the contradiction of this is the more you talk about this, the more people want to go there and the more pressure you put on it, but people are going to go there anyway. And I guess I feel like this will have a more unbalanced, more positive impact, I hope. But the Copper River, you know, and then I also, like, my family has this relatively small patch of land in western Massachusetts. It's 150 acres that used to be my grandfather's farm. And we've spent the last 10 years trying to figure out how to preserve it and put a conservation restriction on it. And it's been a very crunchy, drawn-out, difficult process. And I've thought about writing about that place, which is a very small piece of land and a very small and in no way extraordinary place. It's just part of a landscape that's more and more fragmented. And, you know, we're trying to knit together a few pieces of land that sort of turn into this wildlife corridor. So, you know, I think about that also. That's not far from, you know, anybody's experience, really. And so, you know, I think about places that are very far and places that are very close. And I don't know, I might not ever write another book because I don't know how I can make a living writing books.
So, you know, which is not an exhortation for everybody to hear to buy the book, because that's, you know, it's not the economics of the industry and of the way my brain works slowly just add up to, you know, it's not a going concern. So, you know, I had this sort of extraordinary opportunity to do this because of all the stuff that I said in the beginning there. I didn't, you know, I wasn't married, I didn't have any kids. My mother died and she left like a small pot of money that I was able to live off for a while, and you know, I didn't have to have a full-time job and I didn't have very many other responsibilities. So, you know, that's not something that many people have or many people want. It's not something I wanted, you know, but it happened and that allowed me to do this. So, we'll see. Yes?
Yeah, you mentioned, or in the blurb or someplace, that you felt that this was an experience of self-discovery. And I'm wondering if you feel that at the end of this that you did come back a different person. And maybe a related question, I'm wondering, in relationship to your brother, did your relationship change after this trip?
Yeah, it did, although I don't see much of him. And he lives in Oregon now, in a far corner of Oregon that's hard to get to. You know, I'm frankly, you know, a little sorry that after this that we haven't been able to spend more time together and sort of, you know, maintain the closeness that we had and that we developed. I mean, we were, you know, fairly close going into it, in terms of like the landscape of our family. But I'd be lying if I said that it was, you know, this profound bonding experience that he and I had shared together. I mean, it was a bonding experience and it was an incredible experience, but when it's done, we both kind of went off and lived our own lives. And, you know, at different points I sort of tried to draw him into the project a bit more, and he just, you know, he's got his own life. He's now 30 years old and he's, you know, got a lot of different kind of living to do than I have done. Some of his pictures are in here, which is great, and he pops up at different points. As for me, I mean, that was one of the reasons I thought I didn't really have a book for a while, was because like I didn't have this like great epiphany in the course of this trip that like, you know, I've found the meaning of life or even the meaning of my life or, you know, what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. But when I started, I didn't think I was a guy who could write a book. So I don't know. I mean, I'm definitely a different person, but exactly how? It's, I'm not completely able to say. You know.
So. Can I ask one more question?
Sure.
I think of these deep lakes as having a mythology, that there's always some monster, you know,
yeah.
Or that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Is that?
You know, there is not a mythology about a monster in Lake Baikal, which is really interesting because there is with so many other big lakes.
And the deep ones, you know.
There are mythologies about the place, but not that. And, you know, it never even really occurred to me to ask, why don't you have a monster here? I tell you, though, I heard a really great explanation recently. I can't remember it, but I met this limnologist at Flathead Lake in Montana this summer, who'd been to Baikal and studied a lot of these big lakes. And as soon as somebody brought that up, he had this, like, rapid-fire explanation for what is going on with that, with, like, convection currents and thermal blah, 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 and, like, in deep lakes that are narrow, it causes this thing to come up and look like something's moving and waves with it, and it's like he's got it nailed, you know?
Yeah.
Not that anybody who believes in the monsters in the lakes wants to hear that, but it was great to hear. He just, like, totally, you know, shot it down in 30 seconds.
Yeah. I understand there are certain physical phenomena that happen in that lake that may not happen other places.
Mm-hmm.
Can you elaborate on those any?
A little bit. You know, one is this thing that it's getting bigger and that there are, you know, magnetic things and that are going on at the bottom of the lake which are similar to what go on in the rift zones of oceans and in the spreading zones of oceans. And that's one of the things which leads people to believe that ultimately it's sort of behaving like a baby ocean. and as it grows. The probably the you know the most remarkable thing about it, which in some ways is responsible for the supporting of all this amazing flora and fauna in it, is that it has its water is oxygenated all the way to the bottom, and there's no other lake in the world that has oxygen down much below 400 meters, even though there are several lakes that are much deeper than that. And the processes of wind and warming and cooling through the seasons really only accounts for maybe the top 400 meters of that. And people don't really know exactly how the rest of the lake turns over. And it probably turns over every 8 to 12 years. And when I say turnover, that's what brings the oxygen, which is brought in from the atmosphere through churning of the water through wind and rain and storms and stuff. And then sort of this thermal convection and turbulence that mixes the top layer. And yet somehow that top layer also then gets down to the bottom of the lake. And people still don't really know how that works, and there's all kinds of theories, and I get into it a little bit in here. It's all very arcane stuff, but it's still pretty mysterious. And other than that, I mean, strange things that go on, I'm not sure. I mean, certainly, like I said before, it's still very geologically active, and they're not sure that they've found the bottom yet, and they're quite sure that, if they have found the bottom, that won't be the bottom for very long, that it's probably still dropping, and there was a big earthquake, I don't know, sometime in the last 80 years that basically created a whole new bay in the lake and dropped, part of the coastal plain 6 meters or something. And so it's very dynamic, and it's, it's constant. It's sort of a moving target. I'm not sure about other geological mysteries.
Storms, or that kind?
Storms, yeah. I mean, there are a lot of storms, partly because it's so mountainous around it, and the thermal differences between, different parts on one side of one mountain range, and the differences in temperature and pressure from, the plateau to the tops of the mountains are so great that you do get some tremendous and unpredictable storms. Well, unpredictable in terms of exactly when, although there are seasons when they're more likely to occur than others. And in fact, even some of them have specific names, like we have for the Santa Ana winds and stuff in Southern California. They have, this storm that comes down from that mountain over there, and this one that comes over here, and they create treacherous conditions on the lake itself. And, we didn't get out onto the lake other than this very local ferry in the national park and a couple of other places that stayed very close to shore, because it was October and it was storm season, and they basically said, you don't want to go out in the middle of the lake now because you're not likely to come back.
Do they fish the lake?
Oh yeah, very much. And I mean, at different points, different species have almost been fished out, which happens everywhere. Some of them have been controlled better over the years, and the main food fish is it's a salmonid relative of the trout called omul, which is not endemic to Baikal. It's sort of ubiquitous in Siberia, although there's a Baikal subspecies or something. And you eat that everywhere, almost at every meal. And that can be a problem because that also, it's very fatty fish and it carries a lot of these contaminants. It's a real staple of the diet, and it's probably having, in some instances, a significant health impact on some people. Kids especially. And then there are other, sort of common, like whitefish type things. The most common fish in the lake is actually this thing called the golomyanka, which is this really bizarre, almost translucent fish that has no scales and gives birth to live young. And in one of the two species is 40% fat. And so when you take it out of the water, it just kind of turns to this puddle of goo. And they sometimes call it the candle fish because it's so oily that, people use it for oil for lamps. They also call it the angel fish because it swims perpendicular to the water column. To the surface, it swims head up, head down,
and it has these huge dorsal fins that look like wings. I have a picture of it in the book, which is kind of cool. It's some scientist out there took it. It's on page, let me see if I can find it. It's in chapter 3, I think. No, chapter 2. Or is it chapter 4? 5, 6. It's chapter 5, sorry. Page 42. It also can, it swims throughout the water column from the top to the very bottom of the lake, which is really weird because the pressure down there is incredible. I mean, it's so strong that, like, if you fired a cannon, the cannonball wouldn't leave the barrel of the cannon. I mean, just it would crush you and I long before you get to the bottom. And yet there are things that can live down there that are adapted to that pressure, but there are very few things that can move back and forth, and this fish can. And so it's, you know, it's one of the most amazing things in the lake. It doesn't school, so it's very hard to catch. So people don't catch a lot of them, and they're not very tasty, so people don't eat them. But the seals love them. It's the main food source for the seals. They're also very sensitive to temperature changes, as are the epicura, which are those little shrimp things. And, of course, the temperature is rising, and that's kind of worrisome. So... thanks for coming.
Thank you.